Good morning and welcome to Art Sounds. This is Michael Foster with Conversations with Creative People. My guest today is David Sussman, assistant professor in the history department here at the University of Delaware, and author of the recent book, Selling Sounds, Commercial Revolution in American Music. Good morning, David, and thank you for joining us.
Good morning. It's great to be with you.
Tell us, if you will, what your book is about in general, and then we'd like to talk about the whole subject as much as we can in a half hour.
Sure. My book is about a couple of ways of thinking about it. One of them is that it's about the rise of music as big business.
Mm-hmm.
And we are very familiar with music as big business today, and I became sort of interested in trying to understand where and how and why that developed. In a more general way, it's about understanding how music came to be so widely heard in our society. There are a lot of different contexts and a lot of different forms in which we hear music almost all the time now. We're sort of surrounded by it. And that's an unusual phenomenon historically. Most people around the world in history haven't had as much music around them as we do.
Mm-hmm.
So those are kind of the two overarching concerns of the book. And the answers that I found really drew me back to the late 19th and early 20th century in the United States. And it's, in many ways, it's a global phenomenon that's led by the United States.
Okay.
And it involves a number of different dimensions, some of which are legal and social and political, some of which are cultural and musical. And I try to explore all of these and then integrate them with one another.
Now, in my mind, this has been an unusual topic for a historian, usually coming from the music history realm. I think of this as being the kind of study that a music historian would do. How is it that you got into doing this work?
I've found myself sort of at the intersection of music and history for a long mm-hmm. time, and historians, by and large, have not had a lot to say about music. And musicologists and people in the discipline of music have not been, to my mind, sufficiently historical, I guess,
okay.
in exploring sort of the some of the broader context and some of the issues that animate musical development. So this is sort of an interest of mine,
mm-hmm.
and how I came to it was that I've been exploring sort of the music in history and sound in history for some time, and this was the sort of bigger question that I realized that was at the core of a lot of things that I was drawn to.
Okay. And it also kind of represents a trend that's going on, doesn't it, with overlapping disciplines, scholars investigating things where the disciplines overlap.
Yes.
And I think a greater interest on the part of historians, including music historians, in the cultural history, which I find a very good move. I mean, it's not recent, but fairly recent.
Fairly recent, yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, I definitely see myself in both contexts.
Mm.
I mean, among the kind of work I do as a historian would not have been done 30 years ago.
No.
And I'm building on a much richer, broader base of cultural history that's developed in history in the last 30 years. And likewise, as I'm sure you know, there's this field of new musicology
mm-hmm.
and new historical approaches to thinking about music within the discipline of music. That I've benefited a great deal from, and hopefully I'm able to make a contribution to as well.
Exactly. Before we go deeper, I want to ask one more question, a more general question. This has been a time, people say, of enormous change in the music industry. How far up, so to speak, does your book go? What is the cutoff date?
The cutoff date, the sort of main part of the book ends in the late 1920s, early 1930s. The reason for that is that one of the things that I argue is that the sort of musical world and this sound world that we occupy today, I argue basically that the foundation of that is set in the 50 years that end in the late 1920s and 1930s.
Okay.
So it's about a kind of origin story. The conclusion of the book, however, is an attempt to, or the epilogue of the book, I should say, is an attempt to connect the issues that you get to by the end of the main part of the book up to today and to sort of raise some of the salient issues that are on a lot of people's minds and trying to develop some of the context in which we might think about them. So that's the epilogue of the book. I think it does have relevance for thinking about today.
Because, as I said, people are talking about the revolution in the music industry, and that certainly will have effects that we can't really imagine right now, as is true of most things that deal with computers. We can predict, but it never quite happens the way we think it does. So you're going back to the end of the 19th century to see that the foundations of life as we think about it, as you say, surrounded by music, began. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
Tell us a little bit of how what you feel has led to this, if you will.
Well, there are two big streams that flow into this river in the first few chapters of the book. One of them is sort of more musical and commercial, and it's the transformation of songwriting and song publishing in the United States. And it's most clearly identified with the song business known as Tin Pan Alley,
mm-hmm.
Which many listeners will be familiar with and some won't, which is the nickname of the music publishing business in New York City, based in New York City in the early 20th century. And the origins of that business are really in the 1880s and 1890s. And what they do is they basically figure out a kind of industrial model for how to produce songs and how to publish songs and how to popularize songs. And it's really in this way that we see this model for popular music developing, a popular music model that we are still familiar with, even though the styles have changed dramatically. So the idea of a popular song being catchy and having an easy-to-remember chorus and the fact that it lasts about, 3 minutes or something, that's all really laid in place in the late 19th and early 20th century, even though the songs today sound a whole lot different than they
right.
did then, and with many changes in between, of course.
Do you go ahead?
And then, so that would be I'd be happy to sort of explain more about the Tin Pan Alley and the ways that they developed mm-hmm. to popularize this music. But then the other big stream is technological and, mm-hmm. and sort of the emergence of both player pianos and phonographs as new media that expanded the reach of music, but also raised a host of new issues as well.
Do you think that the concept of popular music existed before this time, as we think of popular music?
As we think of popular music, no.
Okay.
What exists before this time, there's a term exists, but generally it often refers to something known as what we would think of as like folk music
mm-hmm.
or kind of vernacular music. It is usually a term in contrast to something else, a sort of high art kind of music, art music,
mm-hmm.
serious music as it was usually known up until the late 19th century. That was a common term, serious music. And in the contrast to that was popular music. And what we think of as popular music often means something that is a kind of industrial product. And by industrial
right.
product, I mean it's really commercially, systematically produced and marketed. And this is something that, people in the music, people familiar with the music industry today, insiders, outsiders, the business, really look askance at. They're very, very contemptuous of this kind of commercialization, degradation of something. But by 1910, the New York Times was referring to the song factories of Tin Pan Alley.
Not much as much changes as we like to think it does it?
In a way, I think that's exactly right.
And frankly, to go back to something you said earlier, I'm not even sure that the song itself has changed as much as we like to think it has. I think more it's the trappings or the way we produce music has changed more than the song form. That has remained remarkably steady for the last century as well.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
So this is, in a sense, an outgrowth or an essential part of the Industrial Revolution. Is that correct in saying?
I think that's fair to say. I think that in some ways what I'm trying to do is to show how the Industrial Revolution wasn't just about, you know, making machines. It was also about making a certain kind of new culture.
Although making machines was, as you said, important because the piano first and then the phonograph and the player piano were all products of, I mean, the piano, which became an essential part of the middle class home, was again a result of the Industrial Revolution.
Absolutely. There's no question. And I don't talk as much about the piano in this book as I will in some work that I'm doing now, but that's very much true. And then the player piano represents a really clearly mechanized version of musical production in the home. Along the same, I mean, you find the same language talking about producing music and mechanizing music and automating musical production that you'd find in any kind of discourse about industry and manufacturing.
Now, do you think this is a perfectly natural thing to have happened, or how do you think that this happened? If that's a good question. Do you think people looked around and said, oh, look, we've got the printing press and the phonograph and the newspaper, and we can make this a mass market thing? Or did it just sort of evolve into that?
It was not natural. Okay. I would definitely say it was not natural at all. And there are a lot of ways of showing that. I mean, there are a lot of musical cultures in the world then and some now that deviate from this, very rich musical cultures that look very different and sound very different. Mm-hmm. That's one way we know it's not natural. With the phonograph, for example, I'll give you an example of how that's not wasn't a natural phenomenon. The phonograph existed for about 25 years or so before it becomes a part of the music industry. Thomas Edison invents the phonograph in 1877, and for about a quarter century, it doesn't really take off, as it were. And to the extent that they were making musical records in the 1890s, it had nothing to do with the music business itself. The music business was the business of instrument manufacturing and making sheet music and musical performance and promotion. But and really the company or the engine that brings about this transformation is more than anything else, one single company, which is the Victor Talking Machine Company, later known as RCA Victor. And they were the entity that was able to figure out how to bring musical culture into the phonograph business and how to attract consumers to it. And one of the ways that they did this was by emphasizing the quality of the sort of cultural offerings on record to give people a reason to buy the stuff. And Enrico Caruso, who figures in pretty prominently into the book, is really the key to this. I mean, he's one of the keys.
Right. Yes.
He's the first great superstar, and by marketing Caruso like crazy, I mean, to an unprecedented degree with an unprecedented sophistication and aggressiveness, they are able to bring a lot of people into the fold of phonograph consumers. And then you have a phonograph, you're not only listening to Caruso records, you're also listening to all kinds of other stuff.
I just recently read that Victor would actually give away Caruso records to people who bought their phonographs, their Victrolas, as, you know, a bonus. And in a way that sounded very modern. This was in a discussion as to why my Caruso 78s aren't valuable anymore.
I have another theory about that as well. And that theory is that the Caruso records, they were part of a special series that the Victor company had called the Red Seal series. And one of the ways that they tried to invest their commodities, their records, with a kind of cultural value, was to differentiate the wheat from the chaff, the good stuff from the bad. And the Red Seal was the prestigious line, and the Black Seal was the pedestrian line. And they made it sound, and, you know, they cost the same thing to produce. You know, how much, the amount of money that goes into the shellac for each one is the same. So they put a different color stamp on the Red Seal record, and they convinced consumers this way through a lot of complicated marketing strategies that this is a different kind of product. And in my, and this is, I can't really write about this because I don't have hard evidence. All I have is a lot of anecdotal evidence, but people treated their Red Seal records much differently than they treated the Black Seal records. This is my theory about why your Caruso records aren't so valuable today, is that a lot of people have them. They have them because they kept them, and they kept them in good condition. But I have had the same experience. I've gone into many thrift stores, and there's always a pile of Caruso records there.
Well, this came up because I'm also a music librarian, and there was some the usual discussion that comes up regularly of somebody bringing their box of 78s to the library and wondering how valuable they were, and being sort of astounded that they weren't valuable at all. In a sense, then, RCA, our Victor, rather, is trying to market their Victrolas and their recordings as something mass market, but at the same time maybe just a little bit upscale as well.
That's right. This is, I mean, it really is the precursor of the phenomenon which becomes known as sort of middle brow culture in the 1920s and 30s. And it's represented by something like the Book of the Month Club, or the attempt to mass market something that had the stamp of high culture on it. And there's an inherent either compromise or contradiction or paradox in that proposition, depending on your definitions and your viewpoint. But the one of the ways that high culture has historically been constituted is by its exclusivity and the fact that it's not available to the masses. The hoi polloi can't all go into the opera house. And the idea of making this available on a mass scale represents a bringing together of these two different cultural propositions. So that was really central to what Victor attempted and succeeded in doing.
This also kind of represents the rise, the continuing rise of in importance of the middle class as consumers, doesn't it?
It does. And what it is it really builds on a vast expansion of the middle class in the 19th century and even reaches into the working classes. And it's really a middle class proposition that's mass marketed in this way that can even reach into the working class in growing numbers. So the acquisition of a piano, which was the quintessential middle class instrument, prices for pianos fall throughout the 19th century, and a phonograph represents, you could get an inexpensive phonograph for a quarter or a fifth or maybe even a sixth of what you'd pay for even an inexpensive piano.
Right.
And the other thing that the phonograph industry does to promote this expansion is that they're really on the cutting edge of consumer credit. Buying on time, on installments. They are one of the four agents on the forefront of promoting this. They teach their dealers how do you set up a credit system and how do you tell consumers about it in a way that doesn't scare them off. And consumers are used to thinking, credit. I don't want to be in debt.
Right.
And that's what this is really about. And they develop this whole new language. And they promote this whole new language that says no. Yeah, you're going into debt, but it's not a big deal, and look what you're getting.
So there's another foundation laid there for modern society.
Absolutely. Yeah. The music business, I mean, one of the things I'm trying to do in the book as well, and this is, you know, really where I come from as a historian, is trying to show why the music business is important. And it's not just about something marginal and, you know, nice if you like music, but it's actually part of what constitutes modern society.
I'm talking to Dr. David Sussman of the History Department of the University of Delaware, and we're talking about the foundations of the commercial music industry that were laid around the turn of the 20th century. I keep thinking I'm asking questions that interrupt what could be a flow, and we've got so much that we could be talking about. But one of the things that occurred to me is that this is also around the time of the ragtime age. In fact, it is the time of the ragtime age, which was kind of the first national musical fad, if you will, or trend. Do you think these things came to be sort of hand in hand, or that the music affected the way it was marketed, or vice versa, or all of the above?
probably all of the above. Ragtime is important here, and one of the things that, that does change quite dramatically in vernacular music is the sort of permanent place of a kind of jaunty African-American rooted syncopation in American vernacular music. And the Tin Pan Alley songs that predate the ragtime revolution tend to be much stiffer and musically less interesting. Today, they sound very foreign to our ears, whereas the ragtime numbers sound much more familiar. And part of this commercial revolution in American music, as I call it in the book, is figuring out what is the commercial appeal here, how do you maximize it, how do you send it out around the country. And even before radio, which was one of the things about radio is it is a great marketing medium.
Mm-hmm.
But before radio, was there such a thing as a national market for a song? And the answer is yes, there was, and it was through vaudeville.
Okay.
And the Tin Pan Alley publishers in New York would attract the latest vaudeville performers in New York, who would then go out on these road shows, and they would go out on there were two different tiers, two different levels. There was the big time, they would go to the big cities and the big theaters, the prestigious ones, and there was the small time, which would go to the mediocre ones or the small, medium towns all over the country. They would travel on these circuits, and from New York, you could plant, the publishers could get a performer to adopt a song into his or her repertoire, and then take that song performance by performance all over the country. And they would do this not only by virtue of having written a catchy tune, but also through cash payments.
Right.
And there was a very extensive, systematized way of doing this. So that these performers were getting had sort of what we would say is multiple revenue streams. They were getting paid by their vaudeville company, and they were getting paid by the music publishers as well.
So again, not much has changed.
Right.
You mentioned earlier at the beginning of the program, and I'm just sort of, I think, taking pot shots here in asking the questions. You mentioned that there were things happening in the legal world that also were important to what was happening in the musical world. What might that be?
Well, there are two big dimensions here. One is the ability of the phonograph industry to really use patent law to its advantage. And it's a little technical, and I don't think it's maybe worth getting into at length here. More broadly applicable is the way that the music industry was at the forefront of copyright law in the 20th century. And the music industry was represented, they had more witnesses, more people testifying at the copyright hearings in 1907, 1908, the ones that led to the landmark Copyright Act of 1909, which basically sets the whole structure of American copyright law for the 20th century. It was driven by and largely defined by the interests of the music industry. And the music industry had within it different constituencies or different entities, not all of whom felt the same way. The publishers wanted to be able to get royalties for the record company's versions of their songs. The record company said, why should we give you any money? Why should we pay you royalties? We bought a copy of the sheet music.
Sounds familiar too, doesn't it?
Yeah. I bought it. Why can't I do anything I want with it?
Exactly.
So the copyright issues and the way that they become important, really important in defining what music is, who owns it, or the idea that music is something that can be owned, the idea that there is a single iteration that becomes definitive of a piece of music. I mean, a piece of music isn't something that exists as a performance or as a process, mm-hmm. or as a dynamic, but it is a product.
A product,
at a,
right.
At a certain moment, you define what that product is. Here it's something you're writing, you're composing, and then you copyright it. And that is the entity, the legal entity, that will then can be sold or transferred or sued over or what have you.
So that, too, becomes, as you said, a really essential part of the whole marketing, that this is not just something that goes out into the air, a song, but rather, as you say, a product, which then becomes marketed and all of that in, through the great mechanism that's been set up.
Yeah. And you can see this because, obviously, one of the ways it's sort of, you know, telescoping forward a little bit, sheet music is not so important today.
Mm-hmm.
But what started in the early 20th century that is so important is that the music business became not just about sheet music, but about the copyrights, mm-hmm. about marketing copyrights. And so, you know, as radio and records and CDs and eventually beyond CDs, as that became the music business, what is still at the core of that is the buying and selling of copyrights. You know, in different forms, licensing music, or whenever you hear music in a restaurant, that music is being paid for. When you hear music in a hospital or on the airplane, that music is being licensed. And that's based on these copyright principles.
And in fact, our mutual employer buys a blanket license for the University of Delaware to cover all copyrighted performance of all copyrighted music by any university entity. As another example of how these things work.
Yes. And to me, this is exactly the kind of thing that really indicates how invisible the music industry becomes. It's very easy to live your life and not think that there's any kind of commercial architecture, commercial infrastructure that controls whether or not you're allowed to play a certain song. If the university didn't have such a license, it could be sued when the marching band played, Celebration after a big victory or something. And this is, or the most extreme example of how this architecture of copyright really penetrates places unknown is the song "Happy Birthday to You."
Yes.
Which is, most people don't know, is actually a copyrighted work. It is, you know, we think it belongs to each one of us, you know, because it's so woven into our lives. Mm-hmm. But in fact, it belongs to the Warner Music Group. And
somehow that makes it even worse. I was thinking you were going to give the name of the composer, but you're right.
Oh, the composers haven't owned it for many, many years.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. David Sussman, we're coming to the end of our half hour, and I have a feeling we could have probably talked for a couple of hours, so maybe I can persuade you to come back again and talk a little bit more about this wonderful subject, because it does have a great deal of impact on the way we're living our lives today. I want to thank you for joining us, and once again, the name of your book is Selling Sounds, Commercial Revolution in American Music. Is that Oxford? Do I remember?
Harvard University.
Harvard University Press. Okay. Thank you so much for joining us here on Art Sounds.
Thank you for having me.
Okay.